Education and Economic Development, Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Schaefer, will you take the role?
Pulaski.
Present.
Pulaski, present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Keel. Keel. Bierman.
Present.
Bierman, present. Bliss. Bliss. Burkle.
Burkle, present.
Burkle, present. Edelson.
Present.
Edelson, present. Frazier.
Present.
Frazier, present. Hamilton.
Present.
Hamilton, present. Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Liz Lagarde, present. McDonald.
Present.
McDonald, present. Sandstead.
Present.
Sandstead, present. Sundin.
Present.
Sundin, present. Keel. And Bliss.
Present.
Bliss, present. Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Representative Sandell, do you have a motion for us?
I do, Mr. Chair. I read the minutes and I move to their adoption.
Representative Sandell moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, aye. Nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members are going to have an informational hearing today on House File 444. It's a continuation of the hearing that we had on January 27th. Only then it was Senate File 7. The bill is a simple one-sentence bill. You should have it in your packets. If you don't, I'll read the one-sentence change. The one-sentence change would add to Section 1, Subdivision 5 of Chapter 12B that a disaster does not include a catastrophe caused by civil unrest. Although it is a sentence and a simple declarative sentence, it has major ramifications in numerous ways. We started that discussion on January 27th. We're going to continue it today. I have a number of presenters, and I'll have them present, and then we'll open it up for questions from the committee. So with that, Joe Kelly, Director of Homeland Security, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. For the record, I'm Joe Kelly, and I serve as the State Emergency Management Director with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before your committee again and share some thoughts on House File 444. A couple weeks ago, I testified on the status of the disaster assistance contingency account, and members asked questions about the use of that account to reimburse Minneapolis for some of the damages caused by the civil unrest last summer. And as members will recall, the eligible expenses were limited to uninsured damage to public infrastructure and response costs directly related to fires out of the estimated hundreds of millions of dollars of property damage in the city. Only the costs related to fire are eligible for reimbursement by FEMA under the Stafford Act, and by extension, the state disaster assistance absent federal aid under Chapter 12B. I walked through the process of applying for federal disaster assistance and explained how FEMA validated nearly $16 million of eligible costs associated with those fires. Further, I explained that when the president declined to declare a federal disaster upon original request and appeal, the incident became by law eligible for state disaster assistance under Chapter 12B.25. Mr. Chair, I really appreciated your comments during a subsequent hearing during which you introduced House File 38 to appropriate $30 million for deposit into the disaster account. Thank you for that bill. And to my recollection, that day you made it clear that nothing illegal was done in authorizing state disaster assistance for Minnesota. And that is really to my first substantive comment on the bill before you. In making my recommendation and the governor authorizing state disaster assistance, we followed the law. Both the federal Stafford Act and Minnesota Statutes Chapter 12B. It is concerning that the proposed change would be retroactive to January 1st, 2020, undoing a governor's disaster relief authorization to local governments that were made at the time following the law that was in effect, both the time of the event and the decision, and quite frankly, that law is still in effect today. That would not only change the rules of the game, so to speak, but also change the rules after the fact and undo a gubernatorial decision. Second, if civil unrest is going to be excluded as a cause of an eligible catastrophe or disaster, I strongly suggest that the legislature include a specific definition of civil unrest in the statute in order to avoid subjective application of that prohibition. I would ask, Mr. Chair and members, that you don't interpret my testimony this morning as advocating that civil unrest be included as an eligible cause. It's currently not included in that definition, and I'm not suggesting that it should be. What is included and what was used to determine that Minneapolis and Hennepin County had expenses that are eligible for assistance is the portion of the statutory definition of a major disaster that reads, or regardless of cause, any fire, flood, or explosion. Third, I urge some caution that with limiting the state disaster assistance program solely to natural disasters. In the complex world we live in, disastrous impacts could be triggered by technology failures, human error, and intentional acts, including those that wouldn't be considered civil unrest. For example, the failure of a component of a digital control at a water control facility could cause flooding that couldn't or wouldn't be attributed to natural causes. It would be a technological failure. Similarly, a terrorist attack or malicious vandalism could trigger the loss of electric or natural gas service during our cold weather season, causing property damage and putting life and safety at risk. And again, I don't believe that would be considered either civil unrest nor a natural disaster. During a hearing in the other legislative body on the companion bill to House File 444, I was asked to contact my counterparts in states that had experienced civil unrest over the past year and ask if their communities received disaster assistance for those events. And I personally called the state emergency management directors in Wisconsin, Oregon, and Washington State about the damages that they had in Kenosha, Portland, and Seattle, respectively. And they all verified that they did not apply nor receive any disaster assistance. And they were all quick to point out, because unlike our damages, none of theirs were caused by fire. Their extra law enforcement costs, protective measures, and non-fire damage to property were determined, just like we did here, to be ineligible for disaster assistance. Mr. Chair, my last comment is that our state disaster assistance program is modeled and structured after FEMA's public assistance program, which many Minnesota communities are familiar with and have benefited from. So following the Stafford Act and FEMA's program guidance allows us to have one set of rules. There's a simplicity and elegance and effectiveness that comes with the state and federal programs mirroring each other. We don't have to develop and maintain rules, guidelines, standards, or procedures because we simply follow the federal rules for the Minnesota program. I worry that diverging from FEMA's eligibility standards could begin to chip away at that and create a precedent where an incident causes or categories of work that are either unpopular, expensive, or seem to favor one part of the state over the other could be excluded from coverage. Mr. Chair and members, I close simply by saying thank you for your support of disaster assistance and the contingency account and the program to provide relief for qualifying events, especially those when federal aid is not available. It has served your communities in our state very well since it was established in 2014. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Kelly, if you'd stay with us, I want to have the other two presenters present, and then I'll open it up for questions. So next on my list is Eric Waggy, Hennepin County Emergency Manager. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Waggy. I am the Emergency Management Director of Hennepin County. I'm also the one of the past presidents of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. I had some slides. I don't know if they were able to be put up, or should I share them from here?
I think, Mr. Wirth, do you have the slides and you can put them up for him?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just give me 1 minute.
All right. I think it's a little easier if we do it on this end, and then you're free just to comment as we put them up.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, while he's putting those up, I would like to thank the committee for taking this testimony and the legislature for your past support in the emergency management programs of the state. I believe that Minnesota has a particularly useful and effective emergency management law and assistance program that all of us emergency managers really appreciate and find useful to help our communities in disasters. So thank you. And I've got the slides up. Next slide, please. So one of the most important theories is that most disaster response recovery is based at the local level, but disaster assistance programs exist really at the state and federal level, and they're designed to help provide relief to those local governments that have to expend resources and fight these hazards and disasters. In Minnesota, as Director Kelly mentioned, state assistance is really determined using federal processes, and so to some extent, they're intertwined. In order for this assistance to flow, requesting governments must show that they've fully committed their available resources and those of their neighbors that they have mutual aid agreements with in response to these disasters. And also to have these assistance programs, they must activate their emergency plans and have a formal declaration of emergency at their local level. It's also important to keep in mind that state and federal disaster assistance is the relief of last resort. So it's not as if it's the first thing that we use. It is after all insurance and relief programs and other types of resources have been tapped or determined to be ineligible for these particular disasters. The last thing we go for is, and we're eligible for, is either a federal disaster when those come down or the state program that we're discussing. Next slide, please.
Mr. Waggy, I think you're muted yourself.
Uh-oh. Can you hear me now? Next slide, yes, please. Oh, there we go.
Yes.
So it's also important that not all disaster costs are eligible for disaster assistance. And there's quite a bit, even after the federal and state relief programs have weighed in, that local governments continue to be responsible for. So it's not as if there's a free pass for disaster expenses. There's a lot of things that remain ineligible. Federal assistance provides two main types of assistance. One is public assistance, and that's the mainstay. That's relief for governments and eligible nonprofits. And then there's individual assistance, which goes to individuals and households. And I think most people are very surprised to learn that it's a very tiny percentage of disasters that actually include individual assistance. It uses a different formula that's for the feds to determine that individual assistance is eligible. And I would just hazard a guess that 3/4 of federally declared disasters do not include individual assistance to individuals and households. So it's really a program meant to bolster governments and eligible nonprofits. And the Minnesota program only provides public assistance. It does not have an individual and household component. Next slide. So when an incident strikes one or more local jurisdictions, the local jurisdictions, of course, respond. If resources are inadequate, they invoke mutual aid that can either be predetermined or is emergency aid that is founded on Chapter 12 provisions, which I've mentioned here. If resources are still inadequate, the jurisdictions declare a local emergency and then can appeal to the governor for fast emergency relief to come immediately to their aid. Next slide. If the incident is beyond the capability of local jurisdictions, then the governor can declare a state-level declaration of peacetime emergency. And when that happens, the county emergency managers join with the state officials to start tabulating response costs and damage totals to see if we are nearing some key thresholds. The key thresholds really we're looking at are those federal formulas called the Stafford Act indicator value to see if we're approaching or exceeding the federal standards. There's a county cost multiplier, which is a dollar figure in damage costs and response costs per capita. And just as an example, I put Hennepin County down as the most populous county, and the amount of costs and damages that would get a federal look, and that is about $4.4 million. And I also just threw in Clearwater County as one of the smaller counties with a population of 8,600 so people, and the figure would be around $33,000 that would garner a look for that particular county. But it's not just the counties that need to have a figure. There needs to be an aggregate state cost total, which is a different multiplier of $1.53 per capita, which means that the state, and these are 2020 figures, needs about $8 million in aggregate for costs for the to generate a look from the federal government for a Stafford Act assistance. So those are key numbers that we take a look at to see if we're approaching a federal program. Next slide. So if the costs exceed the threshold in at least one county and the state aggregate, the governor can request that the president declare a major disaster. And then when that happens, the county teams with the state to invite FEMA in to do a formal preliminary damage assessment evaluation of the incident. Then FEMA makes a recommendation to the president regarding a declaration, and it's entirely up to the president's discretion, as Director Kelly mentioned, whether they want to declare it or not. So in some instances, in the case of the Hennepin County and Minneapolis incidents this summer, we well exceeded our damage indicator value, but it still was up to the president's discretion whether to approve that or not. So in order for the governor to appeal to the federal level or the president, the state must have activated the state's emergency plan, and the governor must have made a formal emergency declaration according to our own state laws. Next slide, please. So in the scope of things, and again, as Director Kelly mentioned, a major disaster means any natural catastrophe, and they list a whole bunch of them, but it's really any natural hazard or, regardless of cause, any fire, flood, or explosion. And that's really important because it encompasses what emergency managers call all hazards. And there's a lot of other types of hazards that aren't natural that do produce fires, floods, or explosions. And the difference is not always clear. And there can be litigation for years about causation of whether a dam failure was caused by a technical failure and is the fault of the dam owner, or was this an act of nature? And as all these things wind their way through courts, it could take years to determine that. And so it's really important to have these types of provisions in there so that these fires, floods, and explosions can produce some type of relief for the local government, so they don't have to wait for the court to opine on whether these things have a natural cause or not. And so we find many different instances of it. And of course, Mother Nature is the biggest challenge that we have, but we do have a significant volume in Stafford Act declarations that do produce relief from these fires, floods, or explosions. One of the most famous recent examples was the fertilizer plant explosion in the tiny town of West Texas. But there's a lot of examples. Next slide. If the president declares a major disaster under the Stafford Act for one or more Minnesota counties, the president also has the choice to bump up in a particularly severe case the cost share so that the government could take 100% of the costs of a disaster. But typically, it's set at 75%, which leaves a state or local share remaining of 25%. In our state, we're fortunate that you and the legislature have seen fit to have a program that the state takes that 25% share on a federal Stafford Act declaration. And so that's a really important resource that the local governments appreciate having that share. Because as I said before mentioned, there are plenty of costs that are not eligible that are being borne by the local governments and eligible nonprofits. We do appreciate the 25%. Next slide. If the federal government declines to declare a major disaster, or if we get very close but don't get into the federal category, there are still communities that are facing some major costs. And so we have this safety net, what I would call the safety net assistance program. That's Chapter 12B. That's really important because it is pegged to exactly 50% of the cost threshold of the Federal Stafford Act threshold. And so what that means is sometimes communities or counties are on the margins, and even though their neighbors may have been declared, they have had storm damages or other damages, but they're just not able to be included in the Federal Stafford Act. So this would help them, or sometimes we have incidents that don't quite get there, or when the president just decides to not declare a disaster. And so this is a significant assistance to many counties, and a lot of communities or counties across the state have used 12B. And it's an important program. I just mentioned that half value that I showed earlier, the Stafford Act. So Hennepin goes down to $2 million for a threshold, for example, or Clearwater goes to $16,000. You can see what the state, there is no state threshold because it's an aggregate of, or it's a state program. So next slide. So the scope of 12B is identical to the Stafford Act. In fact, the language is verbatim, natural catastrophes along with fires, floods, and explosions from all causes. It's interesting that the program also mirrors the formula of Stafford, so that the state pays 75% of eligible costs, and then the local jurisdictions are left with the remaining 25%. That, I would say, is a smart economical way to provide relief, and so that special sessions that go in and attempt to provide the full costs and all that kind of stuff end up consuming more resources than this very effective program does, and we're able to spread relief around a lot more on these slightly smaller than federal disaster declaration events. I have a picture of the destruction of downtown Medelia, destroyed by fire in 2016. This was not a 12B type of thing, but it could have been because it was a fire of all causes, and if it met the thresholds for that county, the state could have embarked on this, and it would have been a faster process, and it probably would have been cheaper for the state. The state ended up providing 15 years of tax relief and a whole bunch of things that are not normally included in a 12B declaration. But there are events like this that could be eligible for these local governments, and they could get their relief faster than special sessions trying to link these relief packages to other bills and all the kind of stuff that you people know about up there in St. Paul. Next slide, please. So in summary, Minnesota is very fortunate to have an effective and intertwined system of federal and state disaster assistance to help these local jurisdictions in their response and recovery disasters. It's important that this system is established, predictable, and transparent, that people understand that there's a formula that produces the amounts that they can get. They ensure that the jurisdictions receive a reliable amount of relief quickly to address their costs in a very short amount of time. The system is also efficient for Minnesota by using the Stafford Act formula that all of the emergency managers are familiar with to set eligibility criteria. It requires local shares that economize and allow more jurisdictions to utilize the program. So that's basically my remarks, and I'd be happy to stand for questions when that's appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Wagg. I'm going to move immediately to Dewey Johnson. Apparently, we have an issue in his area, and he may have to leave us. So, Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and if you want to explain the issue that you're facing that might cause you to leave, that would be fine.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair of the committee. I'm Dewey Johnson. I'm the St. Louis County Emergency Manager and also the president, current president of AMEM, the Minnesota Association of Emergency Managers. I want to thank Mr. Waggy and Director Kelly for their comments. So I apologize for being late. We are dealing with some civil unrest up here in two counties in northeastern Minnesota currently. So it's about 6 this morning. So, and that's really my message, is that this isn't just a metro, and I understand the politics of this, you know, situation, but it really affects the entire state. We're a good sized county. We have an incident going on right now, as does Aiken County, which is a very small county. Mr. Waggy mentioned mutual aid. We're mutualating this morning with deputies from surrounding counties, extrication teams, EMS. So that's happening on a daily basis. But when the level rises, you know, to assistance, it's nice to know that that help is there. We've dealt with incidents in Carlton County the last week and a half where they packed the courthouse when some of these protesters have been arrested and are going to appear in court. And who knows? I mean, that could very easily be a fire that takes down the Carlton County courthouse, and now they need assistance in getting back on their feet and their government reorganized again. And just want to you know, reiterate that this is a statewide issue, not just a metro issue. And as the chair said, we are dealing with it currently today. So I want to thank those gentlemen, and I'll yield for questions and appreciate the time. And again, the assistance is greatly appreciated throughout the state with the Chapter 12B and the financial disaster relief account. It saves a lot of counties and really helps them get back on their feet in the recovery, which takes sometimes years. So thanks again.
All right, members, I don't see a hand up, and I haven't had information from Mr. Wirth. So if someone wishes to ask a question, this would be the time. And again, I don't see a hand, but I might not be able to see it on my screen. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelly, I appreciate your remarks, and I thought they were really interesting. If House File 444 were to pass, would it seem appropriate to you that additional legislation which dealt with specifically disasters which were the result of either civil unrest or vandalism or problems that you mentioned may be a result of technological glitches would be established, either a fund or EAST or access to a governor's recommendation for state funds to assist with the problems that occurred? What do you think about that?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sandell, I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, that sort of feels like it's the prerogative of the legislature. I would just validate that there are events that do have eligible expenses, or excuse me, ineligible costs that are borne by local governments on a regular basis. Director Waggy pointed out one from a couple years ago with the city of Medelia having a natural gas line explosion that wasn't eligible for either state or federal disaster, and the legislature chose in that matter to make a special appropriation and or provide the other relief that Eric talked about. So I would just say that there are events that happen on a regular basis that aren't eligible for disaster assistance, but that doesn't mean that they're not a burden at the local level. And I know any and all assistance is appreciated.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski. Well, Mr. Johnson mentioned problems that are going on in St. Louis County today. I remember in the 1970s, protests in western and northwestern Minnesota regarding the power lines. It involved the destruction of private property, and it involved additional law enforcement surveillance. I'm not sure how that was handled, if the state was involved or if it was simply a county involved, but it seemed to me it was a significant expense to respond to the destruction and also surveillance. That kind of disaster or that sort of problem seems to be at least we should have funds available or a method available to provide funds for local situations like that. You're right, it's probably it's a legislative prerogative, but it just seems to me to be reasonable. Thank you.
Next on my list is Representative Hamilton.
Is that me, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hamilton, yes.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, right? I understand it's a very sensitive topic. And during special session, back in, I believe it was August, I remember it was a very sunny day, Speaker Hortman just called for a recess so we could go have lunch. Right after that recess was called, my son called me. I said, "Hey, Pops, what are you doing?" And I said, "We just broke for lunch. Why, what's up?" He says, "Come pick me up. Our adult son and his wife, they live in South Minneapolis." And so I drove to his house from St. Paul. I picked him up at his home in South Minneapolis. He said, "Head down 38th Street." We did. We parked. He pushes me in my wheelchair for about two, three blocks. He takes me to the place where George Floyd was killed. And there were a number of people there, but not a word was spoken. My son is... he's got a big heart, and I'm an emotional guy, as you know. Afterwards, he says, "Do you get it now, Dad? Do you understand? Do you get it?" And I said, "You know, son, I think I do." When that took place, when that incident took place, my son calls me. And he says, "Dad, it's a tragic, tragic event. However, I am witnessing one of the most powerful and beautiful things I've ever seen. People coming together to protest, all walks of life, all ages, all colors, all walks of life." He said it was beautiful and it was powerful. So I'm not downplaying the severity of the event in any way, shape, or form. Mr. Chairman, you and I were both here prior to this account being established. And I remember your quote saying special sessions aren't so special. And there's a reason why we formed this account. The reason why I am supporting the legislation coming forward, or this bill in particular, is because I think when we have an incident like this, that raises to this level, we as a legislative body should be brought into special session. We should be discussing what's taken place. And we should be then allocating funds or resources to assist. So I'm not here disputing whether or not we should be helping. What I'm saying is when we first put this account together, at least I was under the understanding that this account was for those natural disasters. And with this civil unrest that took place, you take a look at the dollar amounts that are being brought forward, whether it's the $150 million in the bonding bill to rebuild, whether it was the, $11 or $12 million that was allocated from this account to help offset some of those funds, whether it's the additional millions of dollars in the safe account. I don't think that there should be, this is my opinion, my personal and professional opinion, I don't think there should be a fund just set aside to allocate dollars for a civil unrest and have the governor or one person or people not including the legislature to allocate those funds. I believe that we should be coming in as a legislative body because clearly we're dealing with something that's bigger and has more of an impact, and there's so much more behind the cause of the civil unrest. And that's why I'm supporting this language, because I think the legislature should be brought in to be discussing these things, because it's so much bigger than just one event. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time here. And my question to you, Mr. Chairman, I know that this is informational only. Are we going to have an opportunity to be able to vote on this and the chance to, again, have the opportunity to vote on this and potentially move it out of committee? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton, I've got a couple of responses. First of all, this does not prevent the governor from calling a special session. The governor may call a special session at any time and under any circumstances. This simply facilitates aid if the governor does not call a special session, and then we can facilitate that aid. We saw the problems, particularly in 2007 with southeastern Minnesota and the delay in a special session and the increased costs and, of course, the hardships to the people of southeastern Minnesota. So as a result of that, a special session can be called. This bill is in possession of the committee. This bill is viable. When that viability warrants a vote on it, we will take a vote. But for now, we're going to have a full understanding of the totality of what this language means. Next on my list is Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, serving in the minority, you've served in the minority, I've served in the minority, I am serving in the minority. And currently, from a minority, from an individual, from my perspective, serving in the minority, we have a governor who is making many of the decisions by excluding the legislature. And so for the response saying that the governor can call a special session, I get that and I understand that, but will he? And so what I'm saying from a minority, from the perspective of serving in the minority, I think that it is beneficial to have the legislature involved. And that, again, is why that I support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm chairing another committee that meets on Friday, and we're exploring in some detail getting the legislature involved in the current pandemic. So I agree with you that at times the legislature should be involved. And there are times that I wish the governor had asked us and included us before decisions were made. Next on my list is Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think it's no shock to all of you that I'm strongly opposed to this language. I've made myself very clear. I appreciate Mr. Johnson and his perspective on civil unrest happening all throughout the state. We do not know where it can happen. And it's also shocking to me the retroactive language, because it's so specific to the civil unrest that happened in Minneapolis, the city that is a mile and a half from Edina. You know, I looked back because I thought, well, interesting, how much of the tax revenue for the state of Minnesota comes from the seven county metro area? And it's 66%. And so what if we said all that money has to stay in the seven county metro area? We wouldn't do that, because that is un-Minnesotan. We wouldn't say, oh, you know what, Southwest Minnesota and East Central Minnesota have had numerous floods. We're not going to fund them because, you know what, they've had numerous floods. And we just wouldn't do things like this. This is not who we are. And so I guess, you know, Mr. Chair, if this ever does come up for a vote, I will be a strong no. I think the League of Minnesota Cities is also something we should be listening to. They have 835 member cities representing them, and they are opposed to this. So, you know, I'm glad this is the conversation, Mr. Hamilton, that you want to have, or Representative Hamilton, but this is not good for Minnesota.
Representatives, there are letters in your packet, too, from a variety of organizations dealing with local units of government and their positions on the bill. You might want to go back and take a look at those letters and their positions on the bill also. Next on my list is Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was touched by Representative Hamilton's story with his son taking him down to the site where Mr. Floyd lost his life, and sharing that moment with you. You know, I don't know exactly how old your son is now, but I hope one day he decides to serve, because I think if he sits in that seat that maybe you're sitting in right now, these will be different conversations, because he seems to understand what's happening now, what's important in this moment, and what actions we may need to take as a state, as leaders, as policymakers, as lawmakers, to ensure that we don't continue to have situations like this. So I wanted to share that. But similar to what Representative Edelson shared, I mean, I'm really concerned about the undertones of why this language is in there. I do think the retroactivity is specific, targeting in on particular communities that have been harmed by this. I've heard the conversations that, well, this is about leadership. We should not, bail out leaders that did not do their job as leaders. I don't know if that's, I don't, I mean, that may be the way that this conversation and narrative is framed, but I do know this. We should not harm communities and not help communities in our state and our residents in our state because leaders didn't make the right decisions. We would never do that for any other place, any other geographical location in our state. This bill is in place to allow for us to move quickly. That takes me to another piece. I mean, there's conversation about we should have special sessions to engage these conversations because it's a broader and bigger issue. I don't disagree. We have broader and bigger issues that we need to address so that we don't have these issues continue to happen, so we don't continue to have civil unrest because of systemic problems that we have within our state, within our country. But I also don't think that we should specifically point out only when it happens in particular areas that we call a special session to have those conversations. We don't want to call a special session to deal with floods. We shouldn't call special sessions to deal with, we shouldn't specifically point out special sessions to deal with civil unrest. When I think we do know why the civil unrest happened. We do know historically how we got to the point. And I think we should address the root cause of these issues and not have these conversations just to say that we don't want to do this because leaders did a bad job and we don't want to bail out bad leaders. We're not bailing out bad leaders. We're taking care of Minnesotans. And that is a very Minnesotan thing to do. That is what we build that's a pride that we have in this state. And I want to make sure we don't stray from that because it's not only going to hurt folks in the metro area. As Mr. Johnson just testified, it's going to hurt people all around the state. It's going to hurt your constituents as well. So I would be voting no if this language stays in this bill. And I'm voting no because I don't want to hurt any Minnesotans. I want to make sure we're helping all of our folks in the state. We took an oath to do that, and I plan to continue doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Waggie. Could you flesh out the details a little bit on the one of your slides referenced the full commitment of resources and activating emergency plans? I don't know if you could bring that slide back up. You don't really need to, but I'm just curious about what the government's role is in requesting requesting those resources. I'm just curious what full commitment of resources mean and what the timeline would that be.
Mr. Waggie, if you want to tell Mr. Wirth, he'll put the slide page number up.
Sure. Let me see here.
It was one of the first slides, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's like the third slide here. Hang on.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the second slide. Yeah, essentially what, there we go.
The back one. There you go.
Yeah, so the full commitment of resources means that, we have all of the tools and units and resources like fire and law enforcement and all those type of things. We have financial resources. We even have nonprofits, Red Cross, Salvation Army, other agencies like that. Those all need to be brought to bear at our level that we have agreements with. We need to activate a plan that we're required to have under Chapter 12 and also through for Stafford Act relief, which is called the Emergency Operations Plan. Every county has one. The state has one. Cities have them. So that plan needs to be activated. And then a formal declaration needs to be made by the lead elected official at that jurisdictional level, which basically states that we have activated our plan, we've committed all of our resources, and yet we still have unmet needs that we can't tackle with all of the resources that we have at our disposal. And that usually the emergency operations plans have provisions for mutual aid. And so those mutual aids have all been tapped. And so then that's the point at which you go to the next higher level. So a county would go to the state and say, hey, look, we've We've used all of the resources that we have collectively as a county, all of our cities, all of our county resources. We've tapped our neighbors, and we still have unmet needs. So we need help from the next higher level, which case would be the state. The state does the same thing with the federal government. And so the laws, both at the federal and state level, basically say that you have to fully commit your resources or demonstrate that in order to apply for that next higher level relief. And Director Kelly, I don't know if you wanted to, if there's a spin that you see on it at the state level, but that's basically how we think of it at our county level.
Representative Burkle, do you want Director Kelly to also respond?
Yeah, please. I'd be curious. Just comment on that.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle, thank you. Thank you for the question. The thing that I would add to Director Waggie's comments were, when we're talking about these kind of incidents, there's two words we use a lot. We use the words emergency and we use the words disaster. And the emergencies and the full commitment of resources are usually about the emergency phase. And emergency phase is about response. And as Eric pointed out, that's when you bring in mutual aid. That's when you have to go out and make some exigent purchases of things and make other arrangements to simply get through the incident. And that's where that full commitment of resources usually shows up. When we talk about, and we use the word disaster, and you know, we often know that a disaster declaration comes sometime after the emergency is over. Disaster assistance is about helping with what we call recovery and the rebuilding. And in some ways, oftentimes that assistance is in the form of financial relief, because very few or no local jurisdictions have an emergency reserve. So their budgets get broken every time they have a major event that requires them to expend resources. So that's where the disaster assistance comes in. It's in the recovery phase after the event is over, and the help that they need at that point isn't more cops or fire trucks or snowplows. It's providing financial relief to make them fiscally more whole. So that's a distinction that people like Eric and I often make between an emergency response and a disaster recovery.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I follow up with Director Kelly?
Yes.
So I'm curious, I'm trying to compare the two events, or two events that are different, but let's take a natural disaster like a flood. What would your response be to a flood event? I mean, I'm talking about mitigating the expenses and mitigating the damage due to a natural disaster. What would the state's response be in a situation such as a flood if let's say the city of, let's pick Oslo, Minnesota, did not repair dikes, did not sandbag, just allowed the flood to happen and the costs escalate? Is there some responsibility on the part of the folks in the local area to mitigate the cost?
Director Kelly.
Representative Pawlowski Chair Pawlowski and Representative Burkle, thank you for the question. I would say that the attribution, the blame, if you will, is not normally part of making the determination and a recommendation on disaster assistance for an event. How that normally shows up is next time. So, okay, we'll take care of you. We will help you this time. We will provide disaster assistance. But next time, you need to take these mitigation measures in order for this event, to be eligible. Sometimes the federal government, as well as the state, provide funds for mitigation to help local communities make those improvements in order to either prevent damage from occurring in the future or not having it to that extent. So I would say, from a local official, a local government, it's really not part of the determination process to attribute, you know, negligence or blame or did you let this happen.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer, Director Kelly. I that that's That's the answer I was kind of looking for. I think, you know, given the circumstances in Minneapolis last summer and the events that transpired and the sad events that transpired, you know, I hesitate. I really did appreciate Representative Hamilton's story. I appreciate everyone's comments, and I understand the emotion that's attached to this. But Chair Pelosi, I know that, you know, the comments you've made about calling special sessions and, you know, trying to avoid that, I'm looking at this, and I'm going to chime in with Director Kelly. I think next time is what we're talking about, and I think that's the reason for the language, Mr. Chair, that you put in the bill. I think the intention for this money was natural disasters, and I think in the future, if we want to talk about the events involved in Minneapolis last summer and civil unrest, and I think a special session in that case, given how serious the events were and given what the costs of those events were, would require a special session. It should have a special session. So I'd be in favor of this language simply because I think, natural disasters, as they are defined, do not include civil unrest. And any conversations that would revolve around situations similar to last summer should have a special session. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair. I think I'd be voting for it. And I hope we get a chance to.
Representative Lissigar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the committee members for a robust conversation. And I don't want to go off into the weeds, but I guess I have it'll be a question, but first a comment. We're talking about costs. We're talking about civil unrest all across the state of Minnesota. And we're starting to see a pattern, not only in the state of Minnesota, but across the country with civil unrest going far beyond a peaceful protest. And behind that, we're starting to see organizations start to feed the machine of civil unrest, whether it be, all the different organizations. I don't want to get into them. There's far right, far left, environmentalists, anarchists. They got them all, right? But they're raising money at the expense of civil protesting. And they're going above and beyond the average person voicing their opinion on a subject matter. My question is, are we starting to look at these organizations that are fueling this? Are we going after them if they are part of the cause, both from a criminal standpoint and from a monetary standpoint? And I guess that would be a question to Director Kelly, I believe, Mr. Chair, if we are looking at that, or should we be looking at that? Because some of these organizations, they're raising some serious money, and they are a part of the problem with spreading false narratives, rhetoric, and it's eroding our society. It's eroding our ability for free speech in a constructive way.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lissigar, I would say that I share your concern for what's happening there, but looking into those organizations and sounds more that is beyond the scope of my organization. It sounds like law enforcement or state's attorneys kind of work, or maybe federal homeland security at that level. That's really beyond the scope of what my organization does. But I do share the concern.
Representative Lissigar.
Mr. Chair, could you find the right person that could, maybe it's the AG, Mr. Ellison, come and have these conversations? Because when we talk about having $35 million ongoing, it really concerns me as a fiscal conservative Democrat that doesn't, I mean, we got to be wise with our money, and I believe that we have to have the resources, but if individuals or organizations underneath raising money underneath the umbrella of whatever cause they are, I think that they need to be brought into the conversation. And I would like to know, how do we hold them accountable if they are feeding into this, causing the average taxpayer to foot the bill?
Representative Lisgard, I'm going to make that inquiry. It may be beyond the scope of this committee also, but I know we have other committees that deal specifically with the issues that you've raised. So I'll get an answer for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everybody, for this conversation. I was actually kind of in the same theme as Rep. Lisgard there with outside actors. And it reminded me that we, you know, we really need to pay attention to the terms that we put in, the words we use, because, you know, there's a lot of causes for natural disasters. There's various causes for civil unrest. And I think I wanted to hear that conversation as well. But invasion, that word is not mentioned. And we certainly had a quasi-invasion with, if you just look at the court cases involved in the events right now, I think it's over 70 individuals from out of Hennepin County coming in to Minneapolis this summer, 16 from out of state. So it's exactly what Rep. Lisgard was talking about. So I appreciated the comments of Director Kelly on the terms used about emergency and disaster and how that's viewed differently. And I think that that's exactly why we do need these accounts in place so that the governor can act during the emergency, dealing with the moment. And then, you know, the disaster, having this account, that is for the legislature to have more input and talk about it, as we're doing today. So I think those terms really, really matter. I too, you know, want to thank Rep. Hamilton for talking about the day he went to the memorial. I've been there as well, and that is a very impactful place. And what I took away from that, going back to the Capitol, is knowing that, you know, we convene the legislature not only during crises, but every single day we are dealing with the resultant situation of where we are today. You know, I think about the fact that we are dealing with the causes of civil unrest prior to the murder of George Floyd every day in health and human services, every day in education, every day in housing. We're dealing with the issues right now, and that's what the legislature's work is about. I think the events speak to the fact that we need to do more. So I just hope everybody will keep that in mind as we go about our work together. And I know it's a very tough situation right now between a pandemic and a divided government, but we need to keep working on that and accept the fact that that's our job. We're dealing with the disaster of our civil unrest that, you know, we either deal with it now or it's just going to continue. And so just wanted to say that opinion. I do have one question for Mr. Waghi, please. In regards to the FEMA request for assistance, do we have any idea what FEMA's recommendation was to the president?
When Mr. Waghi. Made?
Sure, that information goes through the states, and so that the state deals with the federal government, but we've heard through the state that it was not recommended by FEMA that it be supported, I believe. Joe, you want to confirm that?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and members, that's a great question. I wish I knew with certainty, but I don't, and I'm being completely candid that they, FEMA, part of the executive branch, holds their recommendations very closely. So I don't know for certainly. I concur that with Director Waghi's assessment that that's probably how it went. I would say, as I testified last time, that the people who came and did the damage assessment with us validated that the damage caused by fires was eligible for disaster assistance. So we know that part, but we do not know, and they, quite frankly, do not share what their recommendations are. And that part of that, I believe, is being respectful of the president's, the chief executive's prerogative to make that decision. They don't want to put their boss on the blame line, I guess. So I do not have a definite answer.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burkle, you had your hand back up.
Yeah, just Just thank you, Mr. Chair. One more quick comment. I just want to just go back to Director Kelly, and I do understand what happened with that money. You did follow the law, the way the law is written, I agree. And I hope the impression given, maybe the last time we heard this bill was, you know, I hope that wasn't the case. I hope that was an impression I gave. But I do know that given the language that is in the law, that you follow the law. And I think that's the intent for the new language that Representative Pawlowski's put in this bill. It's just to clarify what the intention for that money really is, and that if we need to look at civil unrest in a different way in a special session, I would hope that we wouldn't see civil unrest to this degree costing that much every year. But we see floods and tornadoes every year. And so that's, but I do know you follow the law, and I just wanted to make that clear.
Members, any more questions? I don't see any more questions. I want to thank the testifiers, and we wish St. Louis County Emergency Manager Johnson the best in the events that are before him. And I assume we'll be hearing about those soon, and we may have to have some impact this legislative session as a result. Members, there are no more questions, what I'm going to do to conclude the hearing, I went back and did some homework myself, and I reviewed the Legislative Auditor's Report of 2012. It's entitled Helping Communities Recover from Natural Disasters. It was a review of Chapter 12A, and it was a review that wasn't critical, but said Chapter 12A was limited to presidential declarations. The state was facing an ongoing series of disasters that did not rate a presidential declaration, and therefore we needed to create a different type of declaration, a gubernatorial declaration. And this is where the account was created. It's a 107-page report. I can send you the 107-page report. What I'm going to have Mr. Wirth do is send you page 22. And on page 22, you're going to see a couple of sections highlighted that relate directly to what we have been discussing today. I don't want to discuss page 22 today. I want you to have a chance to look at it. We can take a look at this next week, and we'll probably have other issues before us next week also. So members, unless there's someone who has a question or a concern, I will adjourn the committee, but I'm going to give you some time to let me know. I don't see anyone with a question or a concern. So members, thank you all. And with that, meeting is adjourned.